History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Happy New Year, and welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And those stories really don't have to go untold if we're willing to do something about it before it's too late. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And when we do so, we're always educated, we're always entertained, and often we end up inspired by these stories from our men and women in uniform. This is our very first episode of 2026, which marks the 20th year that Hometown Heroes has been on the air, thanks to all the radio stations that bring it to you each and every week. When I first started interviewing World War II veterans on television back in 2005, I don't think I could even imagine the year 2026, let alone think I'd still have the privilege of sitting down with these amazing veterans all around the U.S. The vast majority of the veterans we met here served in World War II, but in the last couple years, we've heard more from veterans of the Korean War and the Vietnam War. And the estimate, as we launch into the new year, is that only 42,000 of the more than 16 million Americans who served in World War II are still with us. It won't be long until that number is zero. And our Korean War veterans aren't very far behind. We're down to just a dozen or so Pearl Harbor survivors still living now, and there's another category of veteran that we're going to focus on today as we remember a humble hero who just passed away at the age of 96. Some of the most moving accounts we've heard from veterans over the years have been from those who assign such a great premium value to freedom because they had to live in the absence of freedom as prisoners of war. Their perspective is always so powerful to hear, and I don't know about you, but it always makes me examine my own perspective, my own level of gratitude, and it certainly makes it hard to complain about anything. But the prisoner of war phenomenon and perspective is something future generations of Americans may not really understand. Maybe sharing a few statistics with you will add some context here. Of the 142,000 Americans who've become POWs since World War I, 130,000 of them were taken captive in World War II. It was that generation that started the American ex-POW organization with chapters all around the country, but only a handful of those ex-POWs are still with us. And the numbers for the wars that followed have dwindled too. For example, the Vietnam War had just 745 Americans held as POWs, 84 of them died in captivity. And if we look at it as a percentage, the conflict in which a prisoner had the poorest odds of surviving was the Korean War, when 2,700 of the 7,140 Americans held captive by the enemy ended up dying while prisoners. That is a whopping 38% compared to just 11% of those taken captive in World War II or Vietnam. Among those who survived, there was a wide variation of the stories they brought back from Korea. Those held by Korean forces had a different experience from those captured by the Chinese. On January 6th in Fresno, California, one of America's last Korean War POWs will be laid to rest. Sam Banuelos passed away December 19th at the age of 96. He was a quiet man who never sought attention, many of his co-workers never having any idea of what he'd been through over 2 years in captivity. But we always try to get the big picture from beginning to end, and in Sam's case, he grew up in California's San Joaquin Valley, where an agricultural boom made immigrant farm workers an increasingly significant component of the culture. Sam was born on October 21, 1929, just 3 days before the infamous Black Thursday stock market crash helped plunge America into the Great Depression. So I'm sure you won't be surprised to hear that growing up in the 30s and 40s, helping to put food on the family table took priority over education for the oldest child in a large Mexican-American family.
I am the oldest. And we were raised in Madera, went to the schools in Madera, and then we moved to Fresno. My dad got a job here in Fresno, and then I went to work in the farms.
How many kids in your family? How many siblings did you have?
There were 10 kids in the whole family. There were 5 girls and 5 boys, and we all learned how to pick prunes real fast.
So you all learned how to pick prunes real fast?
That was our work experience in the beginning. We used to go every summer to the coast and help harvest the fruits. Either working the apricots and also the topping garlic and also all kind of farm work, but the main one was prune picking in the month of August to September, all the way to sometimes October. Sometimes we didn't go to school. Sometimes the first week, because we had to finish the work. You know, that had to be done. That was a work experience. And then I always tried to go to night school, but because of the work schedules, sometimes my plan of going to night school was interrupted. But then I was always educationally oriented, so I tried to study on my own a little bit. And then I was at the age of 20. I was conscripted in December the 15th, 1950. And that's when we went over to Monterey for registration, and then from Monterey over to Camp Roberts for a training, 14-week training.
And I want to backtrack a little bit. What's it like being the oldest of 10 kids? What does that mean? What are all the things that come along with that?
Well, the main thing was a sense of responsibility for the rest of the brothers and sisters and for my folks to help them out, you know, the way I could. And that was my working at an early age, going to prune the vineyards and picking fruit. And all kinds of farm work. But it was a sense of responsibility for the whole family.
And tell me about your parents. What were they like? Did they come here from Mexico?
My dad did, but my mother was born in St. Gabriel. Well, when they were young, they met in Union City. My dad used to work in the sugar mill in Holly Sugar Mill in Alvarado. But then he also be secondhand working the railroads, so the different towns. So that was his work.
What'd you do for fun? Did you ever have time for fun?
Yes, we did, especially when we used to go work in the farms. My grandfather, he always used to look for a place where there would be water, so we would have swimming. We go swimming in the summertime. Yeah, but man, normally helps recreation. We go to theaters, the show, or go see the horse racing, different things like that.
And you told us about being drafted in 1950, but I bet you probably remember a few things about those World War II years, too. Did life change around Madera and Fresno in those years?
Yes, it did. In the beginning of the Second World War, when I was about 11 or 12, we used to see the trains carry the military equipment from one place to another. We were usually camped near the military camps where the farms were, and then we just, you know, when we have different things, we'd run races like that.
You talked about picking prunes and doing some other farm work. Was there one element of that farm labor that you maybe dreaded the most or disliked the most?
No, because that sense of responsibility was very strong towards the family, so there's no complaint of any work experience or any kind of work that was done. If you were taught to learn to work and to appreciate the opportunity to work, and then, of course, try to be responsible and accountable for all our conduct. That was emphasized that we learned to obey authority and also to be helpful, whoever we could help. That was the main teachings. And we were taught to respect authority, to respect the law, and also to help out whoever we could help out.
And you never went to high school, right?
No, I didn't. No, I didn't. I finally got my GED in 1968. That was an achievement for me. I got my GED, yes, sir.
And explain to all of us, I think people can probably imagine, but explain to us why you didn't go to high school.
The work was there for me to help out the family.
So they needed you to work so they could help feed 10 kids.
Right, yes.
I'm curious, before Uncle Sam called you up, Okay. Did you have any ideas? Hey, when I'm older, I'm going to do this and this and this. Did you have some of those dreams or ambitions?
I wanted to be. I used to practice a little bit of drawing and buildings. The way I saw the buildings, that's what I wanted to learn how to do that, you know, to draw, like architecture work. I read books on it, you know, and you know, when I had time, I read books on it and try to become maybe an architect later on. That was my experience with that.
So when you got that notice from the government, we want you, how did you feel about that?
Well, I felt that it was my duty to respond, to answer the call. There were a lot of boys, a lot of guys my age. You know, we went together in Monterey and got all the information set up for the training. So we went to Camp Roberts. That was where we got our training.
And a lot of guys, you know, have shared training was a rude awakening for them, and they did things they'd never done before. And others say, no big deal. It's not as hard as what I was doing back home on the farm or wherever. How did you feel about all that? What was it like for you?
Well, I just felt that it was my duty to answer the call, go to get training and try to defend our country. You know, that's how we felt at that time.
You ended up in the 3rd Infantry Division. Do you remember what you were thinking when you shipped out or how you felt about the prospect of combat in Korea?
No, I wasn't apprehensive, just wondered about maybe we would return back. You know, we used to hear guys from different stories about returning back. But I didn't worry about that. I just accepted it. I didn't worry about it. I was sad that we were leaving, you know, family and the lifestyle, what I had learned. But I wasn't fearful of that, you know. I just accepted it.
And how was that journey to Korea?
Yeah, we went over in the General Walker. It's a troop ship. And we landed in Incheon. First, we landed in Yokohama. And then they shipped us over to Incheon. And then we went to a repatriation center. And from there, they sent me to this unit. We got there in, I think, May the 17th of 51. And then in 2.5 months is when I got caught by the Chinese.
And I'm sure you experienced a few things in those 2.5 months before you became a prisoner. Are there some moments that stand out for you, some experiences, some things you saw or felt or witnessed?
Well, what happened to us, we're a squad. We went over too far into the forward position. We went into a draw, and the enemy was waiting for us. And because they had moved, their line had moved over 3 days before. And we were surprised. And then that's when we were ambushed. We lost 3 boys. They had just arrived. They caught us and they told us to move over to start walking toward the north. Yes.
Can you describe that moment when you gained an understanding of what was happening, when you realized that this was an ambush? How did you experience? Where were you and what happened?
We were going up in a draw. Then this fellow, the squad leader, he touched off a grenade. And then right away, the enemy started firing at us. You know, we were pinned down. We couldn't fire back. You know, we tried to fire back, we couldn't fire back. And so the squad leader got hit, and he ran all the way downhill. And he passed away that day. And it was so stressful, yes.
How well had you gotten to know those guys?
Not very long, no. No, we have been set in different positions. The commanders moved in different positions, but I didn't really get to know them well, you know, real well. You know, most of them were, there was a squad of Puerto Ricans, so I didn't get to know them very well, though.
And I'm sure there are a few other guys in the room who've experienced something like this, where they are under fire. They know what you're talking about when you say that. But had you experienced that before? Had you had some close calls before that day?
No, that was a fateful day, yes.
So you said 4 guys from your unit were killed that day, right? And quite a few more wounded?
2 more were wounded. Uh-huh. They took them away. They marched us away and they took them to another area. It was another camp, I think, yes. Yes.
Was there a moment where you realized you were going to be captured or you had to surrender? How did that unfold?
Well, we were in lying down. One Chinese guy hit me with his rifle right in my head. And he told us, you know, by the sound, told us to move uphill. And then from there on, we started walking, running, until we stopped maybe about 2 hours after that.
How many of you were there that were taken prisoner in that incident?
Okay, let's see. It's six. Mm-hmm. Six of us. Two of the wounded ones, they were separated. They were taken away. Mm-hmm. You know, they were taken away a different way.
So you got smacked on the back of the head with the butt of a Chinese rifle, right?
No, with a rifle itself.
With the barrel of the rifle?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes.
That can't feel very good.
No, it still feels very bad.
And then, I don't think, has anyone else in the room ever been a prisoner before? So we don't know what that feels like.
There was fear. Yeah. You know, there was apprehension and fear then, you know, because, you know, they didn't know what was going to happen. But then we ran and ran and ran that night. That afternoon, we saw them about first. The first stop was about 2 hours after we had been caught.
So you were moving for 2 hours straight before you had a chance to rest?
Yes, yes. And then from there, we were taken to a village, and then from there, the next day, they moved us away to another village, maybe about 3-4 miles or more.
Before that day, had you ever mentally considered the possibility of becoming a prisoner?
No. I just, I'm trying to bring it back from what it's like. It was apprehensive. Mm-hmm. There was fear to some degree.
And so they had you moving
one place to another. How long was it till you finally settled in somewhere?
Oh, we stayed in one. We came to a village where we stayed first about a week, and then some more fellows came in. I was two fellows came in. I don't remember the names. There were two fellows came in. I know one of them came from the first, I think from the 1st Cavalry Division.
And how did your captors treat you?
Well, in the beginning of the year, when we were stopped someplace through the interpreter, because there were some of the Chinese that spoke English, through the interpreter, they used to kind of inform us, you know, what not to do, when not to waste food, and to just keep, try to, you know, keep clean our places where we stay, keep clean, and things like that, you know. But I already had read a little bit about Korea, you know, that it was a backward country, that it wasn't developed. So it was, when you say village, it's a real poor country, you know. The houses were not near any comfortable, just they were like mud huts. So we'd sleep on the floor, you know. And anyway, to me, it was tolerable.
You said sleeping on the floor,
yes.
And you also said, you know, you learned not to waste food. So what kind of food did you get? I mean, what did this prisoner diet consist of?
The first days, it was like a peanut, the size of a peanut, and it was kind of a soupy, and with I think there were vegetables, some like a spinach. I think they call it kimchi or something like that. Yeah, we get that. And then as we went along later, they brought something like from cans from that had meat in it. You know, there was different things like that. You know, they were edible. To survive, it had to be edible.
Well, this, I don't know if this is an easy question to answer or not, but I'm just curious. I think it comes to my mind, maybe some others in here. If they had told you in that first week or two that you're going to have to endure this for 2 years, how would that have made you feel?
Well, I don't know. I'd probably start crying, I don't know. Or, you know, probably worry about it, you know.
And how much did your family know about what happened to you? What was their knowledge?
My family didn't know that I was dead or alive until December, when my brother saw on the television the list that they had released of the prisoners. That's when they find out that I was alive.
It's time for our first break, but we'll dig a little deeper into that element of the story when we come back. January 6th is when the humble yet heroic life of Sam Banuelos will be celebrated in Fresno, California. The story behind how his family found out he was alive and being held by Chinese forces in Korea 75 years ago is pretty remarkable, as is the Associated Press photo of their eventual reunion. I have that posted for you at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this.
When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, honoring the legacy of Sam Banuelos today. He'll be laid to rest January 6th in Fresno, California, where he was a longtime member of the local chapter of the American Ex-Prisoners of War. He spent 2 years as a prisoner of war in Korea, held by Chinese forces, after being wounded and captured in August of 1951 in an ambush that killed 4 of his fellow American soldiers from the 3rd Infantry Division. Every time I had the chance to hear Sam share his story with different audiences in recent years, he always credited his mother's prayers for bringing him home. But for his first few months in captivity, his family was completely in the dark.
So from August to December, your family doesn't know if you're alive or dead. And then your brother, back here in California, is watching television, and they have a list scrolling on the screen of...
I think that's what he has. That's here, that the list of the news. When he was watching the news, they heard the, the list of the people that had been caught, mm-hmm. you know, had become prisoners. It was a trying time.
And, you know, most of the Korean War veterans I've spoken to who ended up over there, if they spent a winter there, that was very different from the guys who didn't have to spend a winter there. And you're spending a couple of them as a prisoner. Was that challenging?
Well, yes. In the first winter, we moved in stages. Every so many weeks, we get moved. By the time we got to the camp, when we were reached the camp, it was already, the next day it snowed. It was very cold on the way over. On the way over, in one of the camps that we stopped, they took 23 of us, put in the small pickup, and 15 of us crammed like sardines. We driven over to this place and to a mining camp. There was a mining camp. Yes. But in the wintertime, when we got there to the camp, to the main camp, camp number one, I think it is, you know, it was the next day it snowed. You know, it was real cold on the way over.
Had you ever been in the snow before?
No, I never had been in the snow. Never been in the snow. My weapon was, they had some buildings, you know, we were able to, you know, just relax and rest, you know, until they did us to the camp.
And what else did your captors make you do? Did you have work you had to do during the day?
Yes, in the wintertime, when there was heavy snow, we had to clean the snow in the camp, you know, sweep up the snow. We didn't make way for we could move around. You know, most of the day, just stay inside a building, just telling stories or reading paper or being able to pass the time away that way. Or just talking to the other guys, that's about it. Yeah, what's a waste of time?
Well, I was actually curious about that. You know, your fellow prisoners, how much those guys came to mean to you, what they did for you to help you survive.
Well, I wasn't antisocial with those guys, just... They had different lifestyles, you know, and they're by the, I remember what they spoke and what they did, you know. And I was more like a loner, you know, myself, you know. And I would get a book, you know, read over the newspapers, and that's about how I keep busy that way.
And, you know, we mentioned the snow, and you'd never dealt with snow in Madera or Fresno, and here you are, a prisoner in Korea in that cold. And
we were able to move around. You know, we had to clean the snow. And then in the springtime is when we had to go and bring lumber and wood for the kitchen. You know, they had a kitchen. And because they had the system where they had a kitchen. The kitchen was in the one end, and they had, the flumes, you know, the underneath the floor, the trenches, about that wide. Mm-hmm. And that would be the heat from the kitchen, bring the heat to the end of the building. And then, you know, then we use the heat that way. They had rice mats for covering the floor. You know, so that kept the place warm a little bit. But it was really just nothing to do. I didn't get the effect of the cold that much. You know, we were in a building. We were in a building that had that warmth, you know, in the wintertime. But I didn't get that cold that much.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the snow and the cold has something to do with your Purple Heart, doesn't it?
I never did get a Purple Heart. Was a bullet wound on the toe.
You got a bullet wound in the toe? Oh, here we go. Okay, so this is what we're talking about. How did that happen the day you were captured?
The day I was captured, yes. Uh-huh.
That was kind of an important detail we left out, wasn't it?
The guy was aiming at my back, and he missed me and hit me in the toe. Because we got fired on. Right. We got fired on. You know,
so that whole time that you're marching, that you're walking, that you're running, you even said, your toe is hurting and bleeding? Yeah.
I didn't know that until I took my shoe off. I felt something warm with the blood, you know. When I took my shoe off, it was bloody, so I had to go barefoot, you know. No, you can't stop. Maybe kept on going. And
did that heal up after a while, or is that something that bothered you for a long time?
Yeah. No, it healed up after a while. We had to cross rivers also. And that was around the month of October, and with the water, it was very cold. It was very cold. And we had to cross rivers, and it felt like, that cut my legs off, you know, that was that cold, you know, so. But you kept on going. We had to keep on going.
Yeah.
There was no choice.
You know, you say that kept on going. That's always something that's fascinated me with the prisoners of war I've had the privilege of meeting. I always think about the uncertainty, because nobody tells you. Like most of us in our life, right, we have deadlines, we have targets. Mm-hmm. Hey, by this date, we know we'll do this. But this was indefinite. You didn't know how long you were going to be a prisoner. How did you handle that? How did you come to grips with that mentally or psychologically or emotionally?
Well, as I explained, you know, I come from an environment where we obey authority. You know, we just follow the orders. You know, we have no choice. Just keep on going. You know, so couldn't stop and cry. You know, just kept on going as we were told to go, you know, until we reached that point. We went to that camp. They kept the Lipton lifestyle. It was a lot of guys there. They were about, when we got to that camp, I think they were around, somewhere around 2,000, about 2,100 guys, including the British, because the British were there. They took them out to their own camp later on. You know, so we used to fraternize with the British guys. There were some British guys that had been old guys and had been in South America. Some of them spoke Spanish. So, you know, we got along with those guys until they took them away, you know.
So let me get this straight, Sam. Mm-hmm. You're a prisoner of the Chinese in Korea, speaking Spanish with British guys.
Well, because there were British guys there. There were British guys that were saved in Argentina. They were older guys, about in the 40s or 50s.
I don't think anybody's ever told me that story before. Yeah. Were there days where you felt yourself losing hope? Or you wondered if you'd ever get out of there?
I guess there were a few days that probably, not lose hope, just wondered about it. What's going to happen to us and to me, with, you know. You know. Especially before in 1952, the Chinese, because they had that propaganda, you know, that statement that they said, that humanitarian treatment, they used that, I guess, to differentiate between the treatment the Koreans had given the other guys, you know, the first prisoners of war. So they started bringing in 52 spring, they started bringing in sport equipment. First they brought a guitar, you know, there were our group. In our camp, there were some guys that knew how to play the guitar. So they brought a guitar, and then they brought an accordion later on. And later on, they started bringing in baseball bats, and you know, guys used to play baseball, you know, when they had a chance. And they brought basketball, and they had athletic activities. You know, in the summertime, and especially in the summertime later on.
How big a difference did that make for you?
Well, I still had hopes that maybe started hearing about the armistice, that we raised our hopes, you know, that we would maybe exchanged, you know, someday, you know.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask you, because I asked you if there were days where you started to lose hope, but I'm also curious where your hope came from. What were the things that kept you going or kept you believing that you could get out of there and come home and see your family again?
I think I was instilled to have faith in God, you know, and I think that's a trick right there for me not to lose hope, not to give up, you know, just take it as long as it came along. Whatever we had to do, whatever chore, whatever job, we had to just do it. I know one thing they did try, I don't know, it's well known that they tried to indoctrinate our GIs, you know, but I saw one thing. They didn't succeed, I think, for two reasons. I think the two reasons were that the guys only had two things in their minds, the girl back home and the car. That's all the conversation there was, 99% of the time. I have this car and my car, and then, you know, but the girls also, you know. So that's I think it's, I think it went in one ear out the other when they started talking, because they tried to give take us to some like a playground, and then they start talking about it, and then the guys would pay attention.
You said indoctrinate. They're basically trying to brainwash you into seeing the world in a different way. Yeah, right. So what kinds of things were they talking about?
Well, I think they tried to say, you know, about how they had achieved their new system, or the way they lived. A lot of guys just laughed at it. They didn't pay attention to that.
So it was like communist propaganda? Is that what you're talking about?
I think so, but the guys didn't pay attention to that. You know, they were the main conversation of all the guys were just cars and more cars. Later on, because the Koreans use the system of the hemp, you know, marijuana. You know, they started the jazz, especially the guys from L.A., starting getting, you know, more involved with that. I think when we were over some villages, I used to use some machines, like big standing machines, that were made of wood, and then like a lot of strings in it. And then And I remember what I thought was, I used to see them weave, you know, the machines that weave, mm-hmm. you know, and what are they doing? And then the guy said, well, they're making clothes. You know, their material looks like silk that is not clean, you know, and their clothing material. I said, why is that? Because that's hemp. That's mm-hmm. that marijuana fiber. Mm-hmm. What they do, they wet the stalk and they peel it and then they weave it. And there goes a shirt. But some GIs were very, how would I put it, very entrepreneurs. The Chinese started bringing soap and toothbrush and toothpaste and all that. And then they would take, when we go to get the wood or go out to the camp, they would meet the Korean people and started trading. So that was the kind of activity, yeah.
And you said, you know, for all you guys, it was either the girl back home or the car.
Yeah.
What was it for you?
My family. Uh-huh. My family, yeah. That was my concern.
And was it cars they actually had or cars they wished they could have someday?
I think they were cars that they had, and that's what they talk about. And some probably thought of buying when they came out, you know, if they came out.
2 years in captivity, what was the worst or most disgusting thing you had to eat?
Well, I got a story about turnips. Okay. Yeah, turnips for 3 months, day in and day out, every morning and then the evening, turnip soup. And I still like turnips.
Sometimes that swings the other way. Yeah. So do you have any favorite turnip recipe you want to share with us?
No, not right now. Yeah. But that's another thing. See, I never was a finicky eater. I could eat everything. So it didn't bother me.
Well, I have had, you know, some POWs tell me that one of the things that kept them going was they would dream about the food that they might eat if they ever got liberated. Was there a particular dish or restaurant or something that you thought about and said, boy, I can't wait?
Well, there was one experience in one of the caves that I was sent into. It had been raining, and there was a puddle. So the other buddy from Puerto Rico, his name was Chevere. He had his own area. I dreamt that I was with my family, and my mother was... We were sitting at the table, and my mother had just sitting away from me, and then I would tell her, well, serve me. And she would serve me. She would reach to me, and I couldn't reach that dish that she was giving me. That was really a sad day for me. I started crying that day. Well, that was a sad day.
So this was a dream you had in that cave, and it was so real and palpable it made you cry.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But other than that, you know, to me it was tolerable. It was tolerable.
And just out of curiosity, that dish that your mother was trying to hand you that you couldn't take.
Frijoles, beans.
Yeah.
That was my favorite, yeah. Yeah, that was it. But it was sad for me.
And, you know, you told us how your family found out from your brother watching television. After that, did you ever get any mail or correspondence from your family?
I think I got only one letter. I kept it for a long time, and I lost it. I don't know how I lost it, but I kept it for a long time. Yes, I got one letter from my family.
One solitary letter throughout 2 years in captivity. The perspective of the prisoner of war never ceases to challenge my perspective. I don't know how you feel about it, but it's time for our final break. This tribute to a special member of a disappearing phenomenon, the American ex-prisoner of war, will continue in a moment. We're going to hear Sam Banuelos' memories of one of the best days of his life, when he finally tasted freedom again, and when he was reunited with the mother who never stopped praying for his safe return. You've heard it 1,000 times that a picture is worth 1,000 words, and the Associated Press photo of a newly liberated but still hospitalized 23-year-old Sam Banuelos seeing his parents for the first time in nearly 3 years is one of those that truly speaks volumes. You can find it at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. In this special episode, remembering one of America's last ex-prisoners of war from the Korean War, Sam Banuelos, passed away December 19th at the age of 96. He'll be laid to rest January 6th in Fresno, California. Sam was one of less than 5,000 Korean War POWs who made it home to the U.S., and he was well aware of another sobering statistic. Even today, nearly 7,500 Americans are still unaccounted for from that war that concluded more than 70 years ago, and efforts continue now to locate and identify their remains. One of the things I asked Sam about his 2 years as a prisoner was how he felt about the Chinese forces that held him captive.
I didn't hate them. I didn't hate anybody, but I didn't trust them. I already had an attitude before that they were very intelligent people, you know, so I kind of was a little leery, you know, of their nearness. Mm-hmm. No, I didn't trust them.
And, you know, we obviously have to talk about your liberation, but before we get to that, I'm curious, too, because you talked about how much you like to read. Well, let me ask you that first. Was there anything that you read in captivity that was especially impactful for you?
Well, no, what happened was in the summertime of 52, they started bringing books, even to the point where they made a space for a library. Mm-hmm. Then the guys could go in, you know. Not many guys did, just not only one fellow. They was in charge of the library, was the only one that read. But I would read the newspaper, just about that, you know.
But I know, you know, since then, it's been 70 years now since you were liberated. And I know that you've learned a lot about other prisoners' experiences and even the contrast between guys who ended up as prisoners of the Koreans versus prisoners of the Chinese. Oh, yeah. Like you were? Yeah. Is there some perspective you have now that you didn't have then?
You know, I knew two fellows that had stayed over there. I think one was from New York and the other one was from Minnesota, you know. And the younger one, I think he told me one time that he wanted to go, but he not because I believe the system, but because he wanted to see what it was like. You know, he wanted to experience what were those people like, what was their lifestyle, what was their system. That was the one from New York. I mean, he's the one that stayed. You know, the other fellow, I didn't know him well. He helped me one time because I became sick because I drank the cold water, the contaminated water, and I got sick. And then so he was the one that dragged me to the, I was real sick. And the doctor gave me a piece of opium, crushed opium, and that stopped my infection right away, you know.
How do you think your experience would have been different if you had been held by the Koreans and not the Chinese?
I probably wouldn't be here with the Koreans. Yeah. Because from the beginning, they demonstrated a lot of cruelty and atrocities. That's what I heard in the news and read in the newspapers. Yeah. They went from the extremes in their interest of trying to save the country. They showed that cruelty and then humane treatment. There was a fellow named Aguilar. He had been a prisoner of the Koreans, and he did get to see some of the cruelty that the Koreans practiced. Yeah, he was a tank driver. But then because he learned how to speak Chinese, he had been in the Marine Corps, he learned how to speak Chinese, so he was able to sweep over to the Chinese. And then he said he did see cruelty. But the Chinese, like I said, they emphasized that they had the humanitarian treatment. And they said that they're referring to it with the things they tried to give us and all that. They had the human treatment, that's why they did it. And so that was the difference right there.
So you didn't have to read about it in a book. You had this fellow prisoner who had been captured by the Koreans but then transferred to the Chinese. And he told you specifically some of the things that had been done?
Oh, yes. Yes, he was from Chula Vista. Mm. Yeah, he and his buddy, I think his name was Paul Gray from Minnesota. They did so. They see that.
And I know it's not easy to talk about, but just for our understanding, is there something you can share that he told you that they had done that kind of gave an example of how bad it was?
Well, he said that one of the times they were moved in the train, and they put the train inside a cave to prevent the airplanes to strafe them. So they were there, but some of those people suffocated because of the smoke of the engine. And that's what he said. So they didn't move the train until they knew that the planes were gone. He did see a few things involved cruelty. You know. Yeah. But like I said, the Chinese had a different policy because of the propaganda purposes.
Right.
Yeah, that's why they referred it every minute.
Do you remember how much weight you lost from the time you became a prisoner to the time you got out?
I think I lost about 46 pounds. Yeah, 46 pounds. I felt a little thinner than now.
What would you say was the hardest or worst or most challenging thing that you had to deal with?
Over there, I noticed, now I remember, you know, I started becoming more solitary. You know, not anti-social, but just wanted to be kind of like myself. I used to chase a ball almost all day. It was just to pass time away. That was my activity mainly. I'd just go, maybe just go to sleep and then just relax, you know, and think about maybe coming back someday. That was about it. I didn't lose hope, though.
Didn't lose hope, yeah. And eventually, those hopes were fulfilled when you got to taste freedom again. Can you tell us the story of what led up to that and how you experienced that realization of, hey, I have my freedom back?
In the first exchange, there was a first exchange in 53 in April. The second wounded, there was a fellow in that group that told my family, you know, when he came back, he searched my family and he told them that I was a POW. They knew it already, but he said I was all right, you know. He went over and he told them that he was all right. I got sick with pleurisy. I wasn't in that hospital. It wasn't a modern hospital. It was just a building, like a warehouse, you know, and we made it a hospital. So they took me in, and then the doctor, he punctured my side to get the fluid out of the infection area, you know, and from there I just waited. And when I heard the news about July, you know, that there were going to be an armistice, that raised my whole fire, you know. I thank God. I think we're going to go. That's what I believe. I'm sure it was my mother's prayers that brought me back. That's what I believe. Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, everybody's listening, and maybe they noticed some of the things I noticed here. There's some things that might be big deals to the rest of us that don't seem like they're a big deal to you. You were shot in the toe, and you're marching all that way and running away with that. And then you drink contaminated water. Yeah. You lose 46 pounds. You're a 22, 23-year-old at this point. You've got pleurisy. They have to puncture you to drain the fluid. Mm-hmm. I mean, did you ever think that you weren't going to make it out, that you were going to die over there?
No, I didn't think that.
Why not?
Like I said, you know, I believe in God. And He's going to help me. That's the way I believe. Mm-hmm. That's what we were taught. Mm-hmm. And that's the way I believe still.
And so you were in the hospital still when you find out that you're going to go home?
Oh, yes. I didn't come home right away. I was sent to San Diego, and they almost cleansed. My body was cleansed. I had some kind of infection. And then they sent me to Fitzsimmons Army Hospital. And I was had surgery on my side. My side was cleaned. And then they sent me to the Livermore, the VA Hospital in Livermore. And from there, I went home. And I thank God for that.
Yeah. And when did you finally get to see your family again? And what was that moment like?
There was only one time when I first returned. In November 53, the Thanksgiving day, I was home with my family that day, but only they gave me a 3-day leave from San Diego. And then from there, I had to go to Fitzsimmons Army Hospital. And then they sent me there to Livermore, to the VA Hospital in Livermore. And from there, I was released to go home.
So, but you got to spend Thanksgiving with your family?
Oh, yes, that year, yes.
Did your mom have any frijoles for you?
Oh, yes, everything. I was very happy to be home.
And we've all experienced Thanksgiving, and I think a lot of us take some time on that day to give thanks and give voice to some of the things that we're thankful for. What do you think you were most thankful for on that Thanksgiving, 1953?
Oh, the return of my family. The return to my family, my country. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I know that, you know, that experience, and those were what should be the best years of your life, right? I mean, that age, that's the prime of life. Maybe it's hard to put into words, but can you give us maybe a little taste of how that experience has shaped the rest of your life maybe the perspective it gave you or the things that you do or think as a result of it?
Well, I realized that I had to try to obtain more education, to go to school and, you know, learn a skill, that there was potential in me. I realized that there was potential in me because I always liked to read, you know, and practice arithmetic, so I wanted to pursue a career. But because of my limits placed me in the position, that I had to look for employment wherever I could, then I still tried to get a better position, earning more earning power. So I went passed a test for the post office, and I passed a test for the post office, and then I got a job in the post office. And then later on, I passed a test for the Bureau of Reclamation. I went to work for them for 16 years, you know. I always try to improve my lot, you know, yeah, so I can protect my family. That's the life story right there.
You know, the story that you've told us, there's an underlying theme to it that most of us have not experienced. There's everybody in this room values freedom and understands that there's a price that's paid for it. But what's your perspective on freedom and that concept, having lived 2 years without it?
Freedom is essential. And on our living, freedom is essential. And of course, freedom has a price. Many men have paid the price. But to me, the most essential thing in our freedom is to practice, for us to practice civic responsibility. See, we speak to our representatives, our needs, our concerns. We help them to perhaps help our country more, find out ways to help our country better. And that's the way I believe, you know. I used to visit once in a while one of the senators. I tell him, you know, I think we can help the country more, you know, more education for our young people.
I know that a few years ago now, you got to go on the honor flight to Washington, D.C.
Oh, yes.
What were the parts of that experience that were meaningful to you?
The whole trip is meaningful to me. The whole trip, yes.
Was there a moment anywhere there that made you reflect on the guys who didn't come home from Korea, yeah, and so many who are still there, yeah, who've never been recovered?
Yes, yes. I was very fortunate to have had that experience, yes.
What should the rest of us understand about all those guys you served with, the guys you were in captivity with, a whole generation of veterans whose war is referred to as the Forgotten War? What should we remember so we don't forget?
I'm going to give my opinion. I think in the history classes in the schools, that subject should be more emphasis on the schools. When they teach the children, you know, the true history of what happened there, so they can appreciate the freedom that all the men in our country have died for. That's what I think.
Well, there's one question I always try to remember to ask, and I also can't forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us this story, that you're the only one who could tell us this story. Is there something, when you think back on all of it, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Well, I'm proud of our country and what it's done and what it's doing to try to help the world be a better place. I continuously think that we can talk to our politicians, to our representatives, and to our senators, and all our politicians, to be more alert to the needs of the people. And of course, I think we should honor all our men, wherever they served, whenever they served, you know, for the service they have performed. That's what I think.
I'm remembering, tell me if I'm misremembering, but didn't you have another story where you guys had some planes that were coming at you and you almost got killed?
Yeah. Yes, there was this situation where a few days ago I had been caught. These two planes went over this area, and there was an anti-aircraft gun firing at one of them, and he missed it. The other fellow, the one that followed it, they fired at him. They also missed him. But the first one, they came in, he bombed that position, and then he took off. Then the other one came again, and that one strafed the road. The Chinese were moving a lot of supply with mule carts. They killed a lot of Chinese. Then, of course, he also bombed again the aircraft, and then they took off. There was a bird like, oh, well, they hit one of their shells hit the tree where I was sitting under, and then that limb just came over, almost hit me right in the head. I really got scared with it. But I was lucky. You were lucky.
For all of us who had the privilege of knowing Sam Banuelos, I think we'd say we're the lucky ones, those blessed to have had his attitude of gratitude spill onto us, looking at our challenges in a whole new light after hearing what he endured for 2 years as a prisoner of war. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today and throughout all these years. I'm Paul Leffler, looking forward to bringing you veterans' memories from all over the country in 2026, men and women whose experiences can help us all understand that simple phrase that Sam Banuelos' story underscored so powerfully again today: freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.